Time now, let's call it 1:45 on the 24th. I got a cheat sheet here. With us today is Senator Cowdery, Senator French, and myself, Senator Huggins. Senator Kukesh will not be with us, and Senator Terrio most likely will join us. The purpose of our meeting today is to hear Senate Bill 92, an act relating to airport customer facility charge. And the sponsor of this is, please state your name and affiliation.
Senator Huggins and members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Cheryl Sutton, staff to Senator Ben Stevens. And Senate Bill, you have before you also a CS that was in your packet that is a reflection of a lot of work on behalf of the Department of Transportation and all the folks involved in this process. My sponsor statement speaks to the bill, the original bill that is before you, and then I will tell you very briefly what is contained in that committee substitute. Senate Bill 92 came about largely because in 2001 a bill was passed that set into works customer facility charges, and it particularly allowed them to be remitted to a bond trustee, not to be considered revenue of the state, and to be utilized to pay principal of, interest on, and any other cost of debt service on the bond indebtedness. These bonds are used for airport facility improvements. During the negotiations with the state regarding the use of CFECs for improvement on airport facilities, they identified very specific issues that in the bill that was passed that needed clarification. So Senate Bill 92 clarifies and expands the utilization of a customer facility charge. It adds or other third party to who may receive the proceeds of CFECs. It also expands the types of indebtedness that can be paid. The CFEC proceeds are not revenue of the state because they secure indebtedness that is managed by a trustee or another third party. Because no state credit is pledged to support the bonds, it is not considered revenue of the state. The bond is a private initiative and ensures that the bond trustee or other third party, not the state, will take custody of the funds. Senate Bill 92 adds a customer facility maintenance charge. These charges differ from CFCs because they are not debt-related. They are collected to pay for the maintenance and operation of the facility. This will prevent the facility from becoming an operational liability to the state. Senate Bill 92 also ensures that a major repair fund is maintained through deposits into the International Airport Revenue Fund. This will be important when the state takes sole custody of the facility in 30 years. An increase in the airport operating budget will not be required because the cost of maintenance will be paid using the related customer facility maintenance charge. And I think that's a particularly important point given all of the deferred maintenance that we have in the state right now. Senate Bill 92 ensures that CFC and customer facility maintenance charges will be set by the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities through a public hearing process. Consumers purchasing goods and services at retail locations located on airport property pay the fees. Senate Bill 92 implements a valuable private market tool to construct improvements to Alaska airports without the expenditure of public funds. This will improve the amenities provided to the traveling public. And I know that you have in the audience here today Mr. Pfeffer, who will be testifying on the bill, and he can give you a lot of the details on the particular project that is in the works for the Anchorage International Airport. I wanted to mention what is contained in the CS. The CS, I think one of the most important things and the reason that we would want to see this bill moving through this process is it has an effective date added to it. And I understood that the House bill, which is the companion bill to this, will be coming over. They just voted on it in the House today. And the changes that were made in the CS revolve around the flow of funds, and it was particularly important for all the parties involved in negotiations to ensure that the flow of funds went in a manner that would ensure getting the best pricing on bonds. And that was largely the negotiation of all the language. It didn't change any of the substance of the bill that I just spoke to. It was just all language and process of flow of funds. and I know that Mr. Pfeffer can answer those questions. I know Kip Knutson's online also, and John Steiner, the Assistant Attorney General to the Department of Transportation, is online, who was one of the individuals involved in this whole process, and they can answer all the questions you may have on the bill.
Right. And if I might, just for the record, for clarification, we're using backslash F, and without objection, that will be used for committee debate. Okay, so that's adopted. Just to restate what you said, this is an evolutionary process that started in 2001. I think Senator Cowdery was the prime sponsor with Drew Pierce or somewhat of who was there a co-sponsor?
It was Senator Cowdery and Representative Roeperg in the House.
Okay, all right. And then essentially over time, we have learned some things and we product improved, and this is hopefully the final fix of fixes to make it operational so that we can get on to the next step of actually creating the facility and making it more amenable and more customer friendly for people that are coming into. This is International Airport 1 or 2? The two sites? One. Only it's Ted Stevens International Airport, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And Senator Huggins, you're correct. You characterized exactly what the process has been, and it's been a very difficult negotiating process, I know, because I was involved in creating just the CS that's in front of you, and every little word, and I know that the attorneys on your committee will understand this, every little word and every little place and the commas and all the points had to be agreed upon, and I can assure you they have been through the process to make sure that this is going to work to the, you know, to the best use possible.
Are there questions? Yes.
Yeah, I have a series of questions, and the main focus of this is to clarify, is that right, that the CFC is not a revenue of the state, it's so that the revenue bond source would be marketable? Is that
through the chair, Senator Cowdery, that's one thing that needed clarification. I think that was in your original bill, but they felt that needed to be clarified in terms of how this whole process works in the negotiations for the bonds.
Are there any other airport? I got a series here. I'll just
sir.
Are there any other airport projects that would use CFCs that are currently in discussion that you know of?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, none that I know of. Mr. Pfeffer may know of some, but none that I'm aware of.
Will the rental cars, once moved to the facility, still be subject to the same taxes as they are now, currently?
Through the chair, Senator Cowdery, I would assume that they would be, but I will defer to Mr. Pfeffer, who has been involved in the project, and he will probably be able to answer that more correctly.
And how many, do you have an idea, maybe they, how many cars this facility would hold? We will ask.
Why don't you come up and enter on the record, and we can get these answered comprehensively here from the get-go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Pfeffer with Venture Development Group.
So the first questions that we look to you for.
Any other facilities on the airport? I don't believe so. The customer facility charge can be used for other types of facilities, but I don't know of any.
And about the tax structure?
Your second question I missed. I was writing down the first one. Could you repeat it?
Will the rental cars once moved to the facility still be subject to the same taxes that they currently are?
Yes, sir.
How many cars will the facility hold?
Approximately 1,400.
Will all the airport rentals be moved to the new facility?
There are a total of 8 concessionaires now on the airport, and all of those concessionaires will operate out of this facility.
The revenue then stream be exclusive for the maintenance of this facility?
Maintenance and debt service.
And debt service,
yeah.
Would that change after the state ownership, 30 years?
I believe in 30 years the state could elect to continue to impose the facility maintenance portion of the charge to continue the maintenance of the facility, but it would be their choice at that point.
And what happens if the if some car rental companies choose not to, don't want to participate in this? Would they be forced to add the facility charges if they're off-site?
If they are a concessionaire operating under their concession agreement with the state, that agreement requires them, if they're going to be on airport, to locate in this facility, and if two-thirds of the companies request that the charge be imposed, then the state would consider imposing it, and once they require it to be imposed or collected, then all of those concessionaires would have to collect the charge. If they choose not to collect the charge, then they would not be in compliance with their concession agreement and, in theory, would move off airport. Those car rental companies that are currently operating off airport and not a concessionaire on airport are not going to be required to collect the charge. So a customer could go off, call an off-airport rental car company and be picked up by a shuttle bus by that company, taken off airport, and would not be imposed by this charge.
And would a company that's there now, say Alamo or one of the companies that also has a rental facility in the mall downtown or something, would the downtown rentals be subject to that?
No, Senator. A customer could choose to take a cab, go down to a downtown location, Hertz, Alamo, rent a car there. They would not be charged the charge. The companies are, I believe, I'm going to get the word right, precluded from marketing that. So in other words, they don't actively steer customers to an off-airport location.
So if it's the last question, if somebody rented one from one of the malls, mm-hmm. facility, and decided to drop it at the airport when they would that trigger the charge?
I don't believe so. I'm not positive, but I do not believe so. I think it's the rental activity at the airport that triggers the charge.
That's kind of a gray area, I was wondering
about. Yeah, well, that question hasn't been asked yet, but I think it has, and I know Mr. Steiner's on the phone, and I'll bet he can answer that one.
Okay, I have no more questions.
Okay. Senator French?
Just a couple questions. The 1,400 cars, those are strictly going to be rental cars?
Yes, Senator.
And will that free up space in the parking garages?
It will free up a little bit of space because right now there is a portion of that ground floor in the existing garage that's reserved for rental car companies. So it will free up some of that space.
And the concessionaires that will pay into this fund, is it just the rental car concessionaires?
Yes.
So we're not going to go to the bookstores and the restaurants and say you got to kick in a dollar now to the rental car facility.
It's strictly the customer facility charge is calculated by debt service divided by the number of transactions of rental cars.
And just you know, worst case scenario, things go terribly wrong. How much is the facility going to cost, do you estimate, to build?
It's approximately $42 million in its initial development costs, including all bond costs and design, construction, equipping.
Everything goes according to plan. $42 million worth of bonds will put a parking garage in place at the Ted Stevens International Airport.
Yes, Senator, although I would say that when I started working on this, we characterized it as a parking garage, and we're now characterizing it as a terminal.
Terminal.
Because it's really a place where people meet cars and vehicles, sort of like when people meet planes, and there's a whole lot of interaction that goes on. So it's not just simply a garage.
I'll try to remember to call it a terminal. And the worst case scenario, I wouldn't say it's a worst case scenario, but the last time we did a big project out of the airport, it cost substantially more than we planned. We went in.
Yeah.
And, you know, if $42 million is the target figure, what happens if it comes in at, you know, $84 million? Just bad news all the way around, terrible things happen, and we've spent $84 million on this terminal. How much are we going to have to charge? Is all that going to be recouped through the fees?
I'll be through the customer facility charge. However, the nice thing about this project from the state's perspective is it's a private sector initiative. So the method is that a ground lease is applied for, and then the ground lessor, it's his responsibility to develop the facility on the ground. The state really has no responsibility for it. The bond underwriters do not want to issue the bonds until the facility's been designed to a level where there's a guaranteed maximum price contract in place with a bonded contractor. So at the outset, you'll have a guaranteed maximum price contract knowing what the cost is going to be. That's a pretty dramatically different process than the state running a public, layered public procurement process. So the worst case shouldn't be that it would be more than the guaranteed maximum price at the start of the contract. Now, and my responsibility is to deliver that. And my track record of doing that is very solid and consistent. The last example would be the new $35 million API that just finished 5 months ahead of schedule and right on budget, and much more complex than this.
It sounds like you're saying that you are bearing the risk of costs over $42 million.
Yes.
And is that
the risk of delivery? Yeah.
And when you say risk of delivery, flesh that out just a little bit for me.
Well, our company will be the ground lessor for the facility. We'll pay for the ground lease, and then under the ground lease, we'll be required to develop the plans to a level of review by the airport and the municipal building permit process and the rental car companies. And we will bring that level of information along to a point where we will get a bid from a contractor. It'll be a guaranteed maximum price contract, price and time. There will be a third-party independent cost estimator that also bids it at the same time to as a back check. It'll have contingencies built into it. And once that contract has been bid and it's bonded, and we let that contract, and that starts the delivery process of the actual construction.
So it may, I mean, I don't want to get too deep into this agreement, but I guess it sounds like the person who contracts to build it is going to absorb that, because you anticipate turning to a builder and saying, "We're going to sign a deal that says you're going to build this for a set price."
Yeah,
and she will absorb the overruns.
Within the limits of what is the contract says. So, for instance, his contract may say, "Well, I'm giving you a guaranteed maximum price, except for these things I don't know about." And then the development entity, which is us, it's our responsibility to evaluate that risk and negotiate that contract. But we, in turn, have a guaranteed maximum price responsibility to the airport and the rental car companies.
And you can see my concern. My concern is that somehow we wind up with a facility that's twice as much as we ever thought, and we, in effect, saddle or cripple these concessionaires with a facility charge that drives everybody into a cab to, a downtown car rental agency where, because in most places you can beat the airport price by, a couple bucks if you're willing to take the bus or ride a cab somewhere else.
I can say that the process that we're going through, as with any process, is not perfect, but it's more perfect than the alternatives. So in other locations, in other cities, the process is generally that the the airport takes on the responsibility, or the government takes on the responsibility, and they either start early before all the plans are done, or if they wait till the plans are done, they bid it, and then they manage a change order process that goes on, and it ends up where it ends up, and at the end of the day, then that is what determines what the customer facility charge is. So the rental car companies in this case that are involved, that are national, that are doing this at other airports around the country, are very interested in this process because it allows the private sector to drive the delivery method, and in a way that's a lot different than a public sector. So it could happen. It's not perfect, but it's more perfect than other methods.
Thank you. Those are the questions I have, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Calvert. Just comment a little bit on.
Yes, sir.
Number one, I don't think the overruns that were there now is really the fault of the airport or anything. I think it was the design engineer, and there'll probably be some lawsuits. Although I was very disappointed to find out that we insured the design guy, so we'll be kind of suing ourselves. But anyway, I'd like to ask one question here too. Say we outgrow the airport, which was fastly growing, and we build a new airport out in the Matsu after the bridge out there someplace, a new Ted Stevens Airport. And this is before, say, 20 years downstream from now. How do we do that? What happens if something like that?
How do we build a new airport? What do we do with this facility? Is that the question? Is what do we
pay the debt?
Ah, I see. Well, I believe that the customer facility charge is obligated to be collected for a period of 30 years to pay off this facility. I believe there's other, you know, passenger landing fees. Mr. Steiner can maybe answer this a little bit differently, but that would be required to retire other debt. So I'm assuming that if there's a plan to move the airport to another location, that plan would have to incorporate extinguishing the existing debt on all facilities, not just this, as part of the plan for relocation. So I'm assuming this debt would get absorbed into that debt.
The existing C concourse, I understand, is about $500 a foot to what we end up paying. Nice facility, but it's $500 a square foot. And hopefully A and B, as we come up to do them, won't run into the problems that they ran into them. So anyway, that's about all my questions.
Okay, thanks, Senator Cowdery. You know, in respect to having an airport over in the Matsu area, I would assume we'll have about a 20% discount of transportation by rental car companies from the airport over to the new capital, someplace in that area. It's a site you proposed. So we're all using our management thought processes. Could you, Mr. Fief, could you give us a quick synopsis of the design, build, open timeline?
Of what happens next from here, what I did to get the facility completed?
What was the correct title? The something facility?
Terminal.
Okay. Rental terminal facility. Got it.
Yes. The ground lease application has been submitted to the airport for several months now. They've been reviewing that and waiting for this legislation and also the final negotiations between the car rental company about how everybody would jockey around and occupy this facility and make decisions going forward into the future under the concession agreement. That ground lease application will be advertised. It's a 30-day advertisement period. In addition to that, the commissioner will give notice of the intent to require collection of the customer facility charge.
Commissioner of DOT.
And that is a 90-day notice period. Once all of the car rental companies have acknowledged they've received the notice and they intend to collect the fee. And we're assuming that they all will during that 90-day period. If they choose not to, I believe the alternative is to move off airport and no longer be a concessionaire. But so it's presumably they will all choose to collect the fee. Once they've made that choice, then a early customer facility charge will commence. And that customer facility charge would pay for debt service on about approximately $1.5 million worth of bridge loan. That bridge loan funds would be used to complete soils investigations and take the design from the 10% level it's at right now to 35%. That would take a few months. At that point, the guaranteed maximum price would be received from the contractor. That price would be lined up with the bond documents to sell the bonds. ADA would be the conduit to issue the bonds. Bonds would be sold. And now the contract is, everything's in place and construction would commence. It's anticipated that.
Where are we now?
So now we're in midsummer.
In 2005.
And there's a considerable amount of underground utility work that needs to be done on the site. So that work would commence this summer. And then in the spring, you would start to see the vertical stuff coming out of the ground and with a completion in late 06, maybe early 07.
Okay. Now, so 07, we're at the point of, we have vertical works done. The impact on the traffic routing, is there any, and if there is, who does the connectivity and who pays for the connectivity?
That's all part of this project. There would be, it's essentially going to be built where the rental cars are picked up and returned right now. But there will be new ramp systems built so that as you come back, you're steered into the facility and then you're steered to the different levels for the different companies, and then a more ramping system that gets you out back onto the system. So all of that's inclusive in the total cost of the project.
But the present rental car parking on the airport, where will they park?
Okay, during the interim, the rental car companies that are using approximately one-third of the main level right now, they will be located to the below-grade level. So they will have full use of the lower level, and that will be for customers picking up cars. And then customers returning cars would be in a lot that is in the long-term parking area, and there would be temporary jersey barriers used to direct people for return back there, heated warming sheds for when you drop off your car, and then the airport's existing shuttle system will swing through there to pick people up. So there's an interim plan for where you're going to operate out of during the construction period.
Did I understand you to say that during the construction period there'd be less parking available to the public in the parking garages due to the usage of?
Yeah, there would be slightly less because right now they're using, I want to say it's approximately 70 spaces and maybe 80, and during the interim there'll be about 200 used in the lower level.
And how many, do you know how many spaces are all together there in that garage?
Approximately 1,200.
So we'll go from 80, you said from 80 to 200, yeah. And out of 1,200.
Yeah.
That's 120 folks that got to go park somewhere else, park out in long term.
I think they'll park in a different part of the parking garage. There's still quite a bit of capacity. I mean, there's 1,200 spaces, not 1,200 parkers.
Right. Yeah. So you're on there's any given day, on any given day, on the most crowded day, there's still spots way up on top or way down the bottom. You just got to walk a little bit farther.
Yep.
Okay. I like those spots right close to the terminal.
Where I'm parked this morning.
Mr. Favor, when we look at rental car agencies, what can you tick off for us those that are committed to this? I guess, and you only have a verbal commitment, right?
We have a written commitment.
A written commitment.
Yeah, we have written commitment from, there are 8 car rental companies, and we have written commitments from 6 of those 8, and the 7th is just still analyzing some questions that they have over the nuances of the deal, and the 8th has been copied on all the correspondence that has just chosen not to participate in the process of getting this done. But the industry as a whole, 2/3 of the industry has signed off on the project and supportive of it.
Right. So would it be correct to characterize that you envision 7 of the 8 big rental car operators to be part of this project?
Actually, 8 out of 8 will be.
8 of 8.
Yeah.
Okay.
Under the concession agreement, all 8 are required to be a part of this project if 2/3 of them request the commissioner to require the customer facility charge. And 2/3 of them have. So the commissioner, in theory, will require collection of the CFC. And then they will have the option during this 90-day period to either participate or move off airport. And every indication is they'll participate.
Okay. So at this point, you anticipate 8 of 8 for being there?
Yep.
Can you give us any assurances or what you see as far as if you aren't in this group of 8, and you're Huggins junk rental car outfit downtown off the airport that said, raised my hand and said, I want to do this, but remember all my cars are manufactured prior to 1975, and your response was, am I going to hear that? Are we going to hear that?
Some
organization, for whatever reason, said, you know, we want to be part of this, and Mr. Fiefer and company said, nope, you can't do it because...
No, there has been no opposition to this so far, and the way, if you're an off-airport car rental company now and you want to become an on-airport car rental company, the airport puts out to bid the 8 slots or concession agreements on a schedule. In fact, it just bid again in November. And there were 7, and an 8th player came on market that was Enterprise. But the Senator Huggins downtown car rental company could have been a bidder. And for that last slot, there would have been 2 bidders, and the successful bidder would have gotten it. And in the future, as this facility is located there, that bidding of concession agreements will continue to occur on a scheduled basis, and other bidders could become successful concessionaires.
So when you say other bidders, that means that could be, if 9 wanted to participate, 9 could participate?
No, I think there's going to be limited to 8 participants. The airport had made that decision, I think, independent of this facility when they did the last round of concession agreements. Actually, I believe there was a position for 9, and under this agreement, it would limit it to 8.
Okay. So that number of 8 is a fixed number for concessionaires. That's a cap.
Yeah.
Okay. There is not a provision to reduce the numbers for the 8 to make it 9. That's off the table.
Right.
Okay. Any consternation about that?
I mean, I don't think so. I think in the last go around of bidding was about 3 years ago, and they had up to 9 slots available. They got 7 bidders, and the highest bidder got the choicest spot, and so on down the line. So there weren't 9 bidders. And then there was a provision to allow for, in November of 04, for a reopener, so to speak. And again, they only had one bidder that wanted to take it to the finish line. I think they may have gotten 2 bids, and the second bidder decided that he wasn't ready to come on airport. So that filled the 8 slot. So there hasn't appeared to be that level of demand from a number of companies.
But the alternative for company number 9 or 10 or up to 15, whatever the number is, over 30 years, is that they can locate off-site, right? They, and the charge is not, they're not charged with any fee factors. They don't have to belong to any particular club or anything of that nature. And they can be competitive by pricing and ever what convenience they have.
Right. Or they, or when the bids are reopened, they could bid and become one of the top bidders and bump an existing car rental company out of the top 8.
Right.
And that, by the way, maximizes revenues to the state, because it's a competitive environment in which the companies are, they're bidding how much of our gross profits will we give you to be one of these concessionaires. So,
right. Now, this system that you're characterizing to us, my assumption is that this is not original thought, that it's probably being done someplace else. Could you describe to us how that fits into context?
Yeah. This customer facility charge, the first one of these was done in 1994. To my knowledge, there's been 10 of them completed since then, and there's about 10 more of them in the works around the country. And it's just a trend toward, as airports become more and more crowded, the car rental process, it really is like a terminal where cars meet people and there's a lot of circulation. So airports all around the country are trending toward consolidating everybody into a tight operating space. It's reducing trips to and from the airport to remote facilities, making it more convenient for the customer. And the use of this customer facility charge is the method used everywhere to pay for these types of facilities.
Our percentage of revenue coming from the person that chooses to rent from one of the 8, what can you tell us what the pricing mechanism and what is add-on charges, be it a tax, surcharge, or whatever? If the flat value is $25 for renting a car, then there's some other things that are tacked on.
Yeah, there's currently the airport concession fee, which is 10%, the state tax, which is 10%, Anchorage has a local tax of 8%, and then this customer facility charge is likely going to be between $3.50 and $4, and that, of course, is a different percentage depending upon the cost of the car you're renting, whether it be a small compact or a Suburban, and whether it's in the winter or the summer. So you can't characterize that as a percentage easily, but all told, this adds up to about 33%, we think, you know, depending upon size of that car. And that is not the highest in the country, and it's not the lowest, but it's right kind of in the average.
Okay. Now, you started to describe that the different echelons of government and operating agencies are involved to make this happen. Could you characterize for us the roles of those as we go through the final contractual agreements through opening? Where we go as far as the airport, the city, the state.
In terms of developing this facility?
That's correct.
Well, the airport owns the ground. They make it available for lease. There's a ground lease that's been applied for. As part of that ground lease, they review the proposal and determine if it's in the best interest of the airport. Then they advertise to see if any of the entities want to use that ground for any other reasons or even for this reason. If they do, they if there is a comment or another proposer, they consider that, and then they decide what's in the best interest, and there's a process for doing that. Through the design process, it still falls in the jurisdiction of the municipality of Anchorage, so there's a permit application by the municipality for building permit. The airport itself has its own permitting process for building permit. That's mostly to check for compatibility with surrounding use, not so much for building life safety. That's the municipal portion. And I believe that's it. Then we, as the ground lessor, are required, as part of the ground lease, we're required to develop the facility meeting all of those specs. So at the end of the day, everybody knows what's going to end up there and how it's going to be built. And then the final step would be that once it's completed, the development contract is completed, the facility itself, the improvements, become the property of the state. The ground lease is still in place. The ground lessor, which will be me or my company, steps aside and assigns the ground lease to a special purpose entity that will then be the property manager, in effect, of the facility on behalf of the car rental companies in the state. So he'll be the third-party kind of go-between to make sure all of the car rental companies that are operating in the facility operate under the rules established for maintaining it. And that entity will pay the light bills, pay the utility bills, and be responsible for repairs and maintenance over the life of the facility.
Under this concept, which you're replicating and appear to be the brains behind at this point in time, the major piece of the operative, have there been any failures to date?
Of this type of facility in other locations?
Correct.
No. There were some interesting twists that have affected the way we've done this here, and that, in essence, is you know, Alamo Rent-A-Car filed bankruptcy nationally a few years ago. That caused a consolidation in the industry. But when they did that, I think it was in the Dallas or the Houston location, the car rental companies had formed a joint venture company that operated the facility. And when that one entity filed bankruptcy, his collection of the customer facility charge continued. The bankruptcy trustee grabbed the funds, so they weren't going toward debt service, and he continued to operate in the facility. So the rest of the car rental industry had to pick up the slack. And in this case, we've specifically set it up so that there is no entity other than this third-party property manager that acts as the de facto landlord to the car rental company. So if one of them were to go bankrupt, under the landlord-tenant laws, they can be removed from the property quickly because they'd be in default under their concession agreement, and then they'd stop collecting the customer facility charge. They'd be off airport. The marketplace would readjust to the remaining car rental companies, and they would reallocate the space in the facility and then continue to operate. So that's the only hiccup that I know of out there that's occurred, and this particular structure is designed to correct that.
Under the category of no good deed goes unpunished, assuming this is a good deed, are there any instances where the friends of the airport or whatever it is that thought that having a leaky 19 or 2005 Ford dripping oil would be too contaminative to the airport at large, that got things stopped? Is there any of that sort of thing?
Not that I've heard of. No, I think in, you know, environmentally it's good. Right now what happens is a customer brings that car back to the airport, and then a rental car attendant takes the car, drives it off airport, maintains it, car washes it, refuels it, and then brings it back. So that's two extra trips between the airport and someplace else. And in this facility, the car washing and refueling would all occur within the facility, so eliminating that traffic.
Would you give us the name again of your organization and your role?
Sure. My name is Mark Pfeffer, and I'm a co-founder and partner in Venture Development Group, and we are a commercial real estate development company in Anchorage. And we basically do these kinds of projects, whether it's anything that requires real estate acquisition, finance, and then management of design and construction processes.
We don't wish this on you, but under the no good deed category, let's say you vaporize your organization. How does the momentum of this project maintained?
Well, our organization, in theory, could vaporize. We've been in business for 15 years. We have a long track record of projects under our belt. There are two founders of the company, but a staff that essentially runs the business, a director of development and a construction manager and a finance manager. And our work on this project will be under a contract to the rental car industry, and then we will be subcontracting to general contractors design and then coordinating the banking relationship with a national investment banking firm. All of those contracts have assignment clauses, and they're all insured, and they're all bonded. So the contractual relationships built into the deal guarantee that there are backups if, for instance, I don't make it out of Juneau alive today or whatever. So it's normal contractual clauses that are in any of the typical development agreements.
The agency that has leverage over your organization to make sure it's done right, progressing a normal expected procedure and opens on time, is whom and how does that work?
I think the primary will be DOT because they're the ground lessor, so they will review and approve the development agreement and manage its execution. Probably secondary during development will be ADA as the conduit issuer of the bonds on behalf of the bond purchasers. Third will be the rental car industry themselves. And fourth would be the municipality of Anchorage in the building permit process.
I'm looking at time here, and as we get... Mr. Knutson, you still there?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Steiner?
Yes.
I think we conclude today at 3 p.m., is that right? Are you going to be able to stay with us until 3 p.m.?
Yes, I can until 3.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a five-minute break here for the comfort of the room, and we'll get back together, and we will go to your testimony, and then we'll keep Mr. Pfeffer present, though, because there may be some more questions. Good enough?
Okay.
Okay. 5 minute break. Thanks. 2:40, and with that, Kip, are you there?
Yes, sir.
If you would, Kip, enter your name into the record and your any affiliation, and we'll be prepared for your testimony.
Sure. Yeah, my name is Kip Knutson. I'm a deputy commissioner at the Department of Transportation. And I don't really have any prepared testimony. I was more online to answer questions. I just wanted to let you and your committee know that the airport and the department have both worked diligently with this group, suggesting this idea, thinking that it met a lot of our objectives. We are in the business to encourage private investment, and the rental car facility at the Anchorage Airport is an off-site customer service problems. So we think we're getting two birds with one stone here.
Yeah, Kip, as Senator Huggins, when are there any scenarios that you're aware of or concerned about where people of Alaska would be laying down their money to make sure that this worked because of something that happened?
Mr. Chairman, I do not have that concern. We also have another group of people watching over our shoulders asking the same question, that being the airlines. And with the hard work of John Steiner and with the Mark Pfeffer, I think we've taken care of that. I think Alaskans are pretty well insulated from having to pick up the tab. Rental car customers, on the other hand, may be at slight risk.
Would you expound on that?
Well, I mean, this is a rental car company venture, and you know, if things go sideways, as your committee was discussing earlier, some of that cost will be borne by rental car customers.
Understand, but having said that, I mean, we're not setting precedents here as about how to do business. It's a practice that we're just replicating a model. Is that correct?
Yeah, I wish it were an original thought and it were mine, but unfortunately, it seems like we can adopt best practices every chance we get.
Okay, so from a DOT operative, from a state perspective, you do not see a unreasonable risk to the state?
No, sir.
Okay. Questions? Senator Cowdery?
What happens if a tragedy happened? This is a concrete structure, I assume, similar to what we have out there, and similar to the 64 earthquake, and everything goes to pot. What happens then, Skip?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cowdery, the law that you are proposing to change obviously doesn't envision details like that. It leaves the details up to the department to arrange. In this particular project that you've been discussing today, the rental car garage, the special purpose entity would carry insurance for events like that.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Senator French, questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Kip, if you would remain available, we'd appreciate it in case something comes up here in the next 15 minutes. Mr. Stein, are you available?
Yes, I am.
Yes, would you state your name and your affiliation, please?
My name is John Steiner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the State of Alaska, and my primary client is the International Airports Airport System, and including Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport.
Okay. You have any testimony to offer to us today, John?
Yes. I would just like to share with you that the Department of Law, myself on behalf of the airport, as my client, has been working on this project on behalf of the Department of Transportation Public Facilities and has reviewed this draft, including the committee substitute in particular, both the original and the substitute, to try to make sure that we're compliant with both state law, our contract obligations under existing bond indentures, and as well as satisfying the needs of the project. We've worked with both Mr. Pfeffer and his attorney, the folks from the rental car companies, their counsel, and counsel of the proposed underwriter for the project to make sure that we satisfy the requirements of all those various entities, and we're comfortable at this point with that the committee substitute has managed to take care of the various concerns that there might have been. I would note that a couple small comments on some of the earlier testimony. The maintenance reserves that would be generated by the CFC would not go initially into the International Airport's revenue fund, but would be held by the trustee. However, there are details that will be spelled out in the final documentation of this proposal. The statute obviously makes it possible to do this, but doesn't specify every detail of the of the transaction itself. The transaction, I presume, will provide that the maintenance fund, will reserve funds, will make sure that we have a good facility throughout its life, and probably at the 30 years when the bonds are paid off, that maintenance and reserve fund probably would devolve to the International Airport's revenue fund to help maintain the facility, but that detail has not yet been worked out. In response to another question that had come up earlier, I can confirm what Mr. Pfeffer said, that under the terms of the Memorandum of Understanding as currently drafted, the CFC is proposed to be applied only on cars rented at the airport or cars that are delivered to be picked up by the renter at the airport. For example, if one of the majors that is on airport didn't have a particular vehicle at the airport and had to bring it in from off-site, that would be charged because the deal had been struck for airport delivery. But if the person was downtown and rented a car downtown and had just returned it at the airport, as currently envisioned, the charge would not apply. The question about what would happen if the airport were shut down and moved, that's an eventuality which I don't even have an immediate answer for, but only to note that fundamentally the bond obligation is not an obligation of the state, and the state does continue to impose CFC throughout the period, but the details of what would happen under such an extreme change really are not something that's not addressed in the statute and hasn't really been addressed in the documentation to date.
Mr. Steiner, Senator Huggins, this legislation only applies to Ted Stevens International site, is that correct?
No, Senator. In actuality, the legislation itself could be applied at any state-owned airport. However, and the part of it, the portion that refers to Title II, is applicable to potentially to any state airport if a package like this could be put together and pencil out and the commissioner were to approve it. The portion in Title 37 relates specifically to the International Airport's Revenue Fund because it is only at Anchorage and Fairbanks that fund is implicated. There are no other projects, Mr. Pfeffer noted that no other projects which I am aware for using this, and it's not clear that at this point anyway, perhaps within the next 30 years it may be different, but at this point anyway it's not clear that there are other potential facility projects where economically they could support a bond through a similar charge. But technically it is possible, and there's no limitation on it in the bill itself that would restrict it only to Anchorage.
Okay, so this is an airport facility bill and not the international airport specifically?
That's correct.
Right. Whom did you say your client was?
My client is the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, and more specifically, my assignment is to represent the International Airport System, which is made up of Fairbanks International Airport and Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport.
Right. And there's nothing peculiar in this based on your legal knowledge that would create some sort of conflict between local state governments to include DOT?
No, I don't believe so. It's a public-private partnership of which there are not many direct models that are identical to this one, but I don't see any conflict that makes this inappropriate or legally problematic.
Okay. And if I'm a person coming from Bethel, Alaska, and I'm going to the Great Alaska Air Show, do you feel comfortable that I have a clear and easily accessible alternative to not pay this, whatever this additional charge is on the airport, if I want to rent someplace else?
Yes, absolutely. The airport does have, well, there are two things. One, the airport has specific commercial, let me think of what they call them, passenger vehicle rental agreements with off-airport providers of rental cars. And what happens in those cases is rather than the car being delivered to the person, a van comes and picks the person up. And off-airport operators do not get charged the customer facility charge that would be applicable here. At least that's not currently. There's a possibility that there could be some charge if they wind up using some facilities at this terminal, as I understand we're now calling it. But currently, they would not be charged, the customer would not be charged just to call for the van to come pick them up to use the off-airport operator. At the same time, the person could, as was mentioned previously, take a bus or a cab downtown to another location, even of one of the on-airport operators, and rent there, so long as Mr. Pfeffer noted, the on-airport customer service people are prohibited from recommending or suggesting that, that if a customer approaches the on-airport providers, the on-airport providers are forbidden from offering them an alternative to, quote-unquote, escape the fee.
Okay, now, another scenario. Do you see circumstances that would allow enough rental car kinds of agencies to opt out technically so that this would not be financially feasible?
There, well, part of the process that in memorandum of understanding that Mr. Pfeffer was referring to as in the process, which is really probably a requirement of the developer being able to place the bonds through ADA, is that a feasibility study will be done to determine the market for rental cars and the number of transactions, and taking that together with the bid, the guaranteed maximum price Mr. Pfeffer also mentioned, they will determine the charge and the feasibility of the project. Typically, the way these things work is that because of the traffic at the airport, it is perceived that there's a certain amount of market. So whether you have one rental car company or eight rental car companies, you will have a similar demand for rental cars. And most of that demand is supplied by the on-airport operators, even if there are off-airport operators available. And the feasibility consultant will have presumably have expertise to be able to do that analysis. And based on that market for rental cars, they will determine the feasibility. I have no reason to think that they won't be able to make a fair determination of that. If they determine that there is a question on the feasibility, it's possible that that could cause the whole transaction not to continue. But I don't see personally a situation in which the feasibility consultant would be expected to get that wrong.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Steiner? Senator French?
Actually, it's just a question for anybody in the room. Some of the committee notes I see envision that the fee would be something around $4 a day on each car. Is that kind of a generally agreed upon figure?
This is Mr. Pfeffer, Senator French. The rental car industry as a whole has sort of set that as the conceptual number at which they feel comfortable going forward. If at the end of the day, when the guaranteed maximum price is in and the feasibility consultant has determined the number of transactions, it turns out to be a little bit more, they've said, you know, we want to stop and think about it. they're not saying no, but if it turns out to be $5 or $4.95, at that point they may say, you know, this is too much of a burden on our customers, and we're going to choose not to go forward. Alternatively, it could be less, depending upon what the interest rates are when the bonds are sold and number of transaction days and the final guaranteed maximum price. So the $4 is an industry concept of acceptability.
There's nothing in the bill that says $4. That's just simply a discussion point amongst the negotiators.
Yes.
And it's an annual adjustment.
There is an annual adjustment for that allowed for.
And who sets that number?
The Department of Transportation.
That is not challengeable, waiverable.
There's a provision for a public comment period. They advertise it and take public comment prior to an adjustment of the customer facility charge.
And I guess the final question is the $42 million figure. So far, everybody thinks that'll work somewhere around the $4.
Yep. The last pass was $3.82. And that was with interest rates about a month ago on that given date. And there's still details of the facility being worked out, but you know, there's still a lot of moving parts. But it's ranged from 325 to 493 over the last several months, depending upon how you look at it.
And last question, we passed this bill. That doesn't mean that the facility is going to be built. This just puts the mechanism in place to let the parties continue to negotiate.
Correct.
Hoping to come to terms to build the
Correct.
Facility.
Yeah, there's still a lot of steps to go, but this is a key one.
We are nearing the end of our allocated time. Mr. Pfeffer, will you be available? Let's see, we're looking at next Tuesday as our next meeting time frame, either in person or telephonically if we need to get on with
Yep, okay. Absolutely.
I have a couple other questions. Nona, you'll be available next week in addition? Okay. Yeah, I think the smart thing for us to do is continue to look at this in a little more detail, and there may be some questions as we sleep on it, and the world's smartest lady over here, Debbie, comes up with some hard questions in that respect. But in the sense of people that are advocating for this, are there any agencies, peoples, or anybody that would have what would be characterized as a checkered background, if somebody says, golly, these were snake oil salesmen?
None that I can think of. All of the car rental companies have been operating in Alaska for a considerable length of time. A lot of them are local franchisees. The national players, Hertz and Enterprise, are well-established companies. My company I've been in business for 22 years in Anchorage, doing development projects like this for 15 years. I think we pretty much have the A-team put together working on this.
Good. Well, one final question for today, without letting out any trade practice secrets. There obviously are some risk factors based on your analysis from a business standpoint. To the degree that you can share those with us without empowering your competitors for your position, would you do that?
I guess the single biggest thing from my perspective is that I was approached by the industry in 2000, the summer of 2000, to ask if I would help them figure out a way to put this project together. And my agreement with them was that I believed it was possible and that I was willing to undertake this effort to get it done, and with the understanding that I'm doing it at my own cost and expense contingent upon actually making it happen. So had I known in 2000 that I'd be sitting here in 2005, I may have given them a different answer, because it's taken a long time. The events of 9/11 really impacted the industry heavily for a solid year and a half. And the players come and go over time. But the fundamentals of the project are still really good. It's providing a great product to the customers. It's providing something that the airport has wanted to see happen. The industry, the car rental industry, is in support of it. It's zero fiscal impact to the state. So for all those reasons, we're still here, still talking about it. And other than that, it's the normal process of getting something built once you get past all the approval stages.
Well, as the chair, I'll give you my assurances that we will do within our powers to facilitate, you know, getting this moving within reason. But I do think it's fair that, you know, there's probably some more things that we need to at least sleep on, if nothing else, and Nona needs to testify. But it appears to be a good thing. We just got to make sure it's the right thing, and then we'll go from there. Unless there are further questions, we're adjourned.